Good morning, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to RTP Live from Chicago in the ASCO meeting, as this morning we talk about the use of bispecific antibodies in the management of non-Hodgkin lymphoma. We have a great faculty today here in Chicago. I'm still back home in Miami with a shoulder injury that's now almost completely healed, but we're really thrilled to have Dr. Josh Brody from the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York, Dr. Ian Flynn, the Chief Scientific Officer of One Oncology in Nashville, and Dr. Ticel Phillips from the City of Hope in Duarte, California. We know a lot of people end up listening to our programs. If you're into podcasts, check out our Oncology Today series, including a recent program with Dr. Zelenets reviewing new data sets. But we're going to talk about bispecific antibodies today, particularly from the perspective of our primary target audience, the general medical oncologist, where they fit in this picture now and where things are heading. As always, we will be talking about the use of unapproved agents and regimens. Please consult prescribing information regarding that. Here's where we're heading. We're going to start out just chatting a little bit about the whole issue of bispecifics and the community-based general medical oncologist, our primary target. Then we'll get a little bit of a take on what's been happening there in Chicago at ASCO and what's going to be happening very soon at the EHA meeting, what to be looking for. And then each of the faculty is going to be giving a brief presentation. We're going to stop in the middle and throw out a few questions. But in addition, we did a survey of, as you may know, if you've been following us this week, this is our last and ninth and final program. We did a survey prior to the ASCO meeting of 50 general community-based oncologists. We asked them, what do you want us to ask the faculty about? What topics are most important to you? And give us some cases and questions. And I'm going to try to integrate some of that feedback as we go along here today. But I want to just start out and just take a breath and talk about one of the key issues that we knew we want to get in here today, Ticel, which is the issue of exactly how should or can the community-based oncologist be involved in the use of these fascinating agents. And I had to bring up, on Friday night, we did a program on lung cancer. Actually, it was on EGFR specifically. And John Heymach from MD Anderson presented a patient with EGFR mutation who developed a small cell transformation. And we were talking about this stunning approval of this very interesting CD3 bispecific and small cell cancer. John was saying he thinks this is maybe the most effective agent that's ever been used in small cell targeting a DLL3. We weren't surprised by the approval, but Ticel, it's going to be interesting to see. Now we're going to have CRS, et cetera, and lung cancer. John was saying he's going to his MD Anderson colleagues in lymphoma and myeloma and asking them, what are they doing about CRS? And I want to just chat with, before we get into the data, your perceptions about sort of where you see the community-based oncologist being involved. What do you think it's going to be like to give a CD3 bispecific to a 78-year-old patient with, COPD and heart disease? So, Ticel, any thoughts?
Yeah, it's funny you bring that up. Before actually I came to ASCO, we had an in-service back at City of Hope because of this very press release. And obviously, how are we going to manage this? Because again, the oncologists, even in academic centers, haven't had very much experience dealing with bispecifics and CRS. In some senses, very early on, it may be that the community oncologists will have a leg up on even some of the academic oncologists, because I'm sure in a lot of settings, the heme doctors will be taking care of these patients very early on in academic settings because of, obviously, we have quite a bit more experience dealing with the bispecifics. But I think the bigger picture, it opens us up to a much wider range of patients and sort of maybe accelerates the integration of these drugs into the community. Not much different than what we saw with checkpoint inhibitors. As you know, checkpoint inhibitors are probably approved for almost every solid tumor in the world, and they probably manage checkpoint inhibitor-induced AEs better than we can in academic centers. So I think more patients, it'll sort of allow more motivation and incentive to restructure the outpatient communities, clinics to handle these things, maybe makes it a little bit more viable, and you know, to have tocilizumab on stock, because again, you're not just holding it for that rare lymphoma patient and they walk in, because lung cancer is far more common. So I think it helps as a whole for everybody to get comfortable with bispecifics and their side effects. And I think in a couple of years, you know, we won't be having this conversation. It'll be more so what the new bispecifics that are coming out and how they're going to sort of impact their patients' lives all over, not necessarily how community docs are going to manage the issues.
So, Ticel, you'll be interested in the chat room's already asking about mantle cell. But we're going to get into that, your presentation on I think everybody's really curious about mantle cell and bispecifics, which you present here at ASCO. Just to continue this, Ian, I'm just kind of curious right now, what are the, you know, sort of globally, you know, the global picture of where a community-based oncologist could fit in? Right now, are there scenarios where you could see the community-based oncologist starting a bispecific and managing patient without the patient going to a tertiary center? For example, in mosunetuzumab and follicular lymphoma, do they need to go to a tertiary center?
No, I think that's the greatest example, right? There's no reason for that any community oncologist can't give mosunetuzumab today in their clinic, and I think that's generally what's happening. There's no requirement for a hospitalization for the vast majority of patients getting that. You do have to be educated on CRS, how to prevent it, how to treat it, and the resources that you need in your community should someone get it. But the instances of grade 2 CRS is actually quite low with mosunetuzumab, so I think it's a great place for community physicians to get their feet wet in terms of using these antibodies before going and tackling some others. Now, there'll be other antibodies that are coming along. We know that epcoritamab is a new dosing schedule that adds in an extra step in the dose escalation that dramatically decreases the incidence of higher grade CRS as well. And so I think that's coming soon. But certainly mosunetuzumab will be is a great first step for a lot of community physicians.
And Josh, how do you see this evolving over the next few years? You know, we were talking about the fact that I remember the day that Nivo was approved in lung cancer because we were at the ASCO GU meeting and it had already been approved in melanoma. But when it was approved in lung cancer, I'm like, here it comes. This is where, and I'm kind of wondering whether the small cell approval is going to kind of give even more of a kick to get people involved with this. What's your global take, Josh, in terms of the role of the community-based oncologists with these agents?
I agree with Ticel and everything Ian said completely, that in 5 years from now, these are going to be so standard, it's going to be rituximab. I don't want to oversell it. They're not as easy to use as rituximab, but these are overall safer than most of the other therapies that all of our community oncology buddies are already using. It's not that they're more dangerous. It's just that the adverse effect's a little different. So the CRS thing that Ian was alluding to, Not high grade, pretty simple, but just a little different than what they've had to deal with before. The tarlatamab for small cell lung cancer is going to, like you say, pave the way. So in 5 years, I have to say, bispecifics overall for lymphoma will be the most transformational medicines either in the last 20 years or ever. And yeah, every community oncologist can be using bispecifics, I think, frontline DLBCL, frontline follicular, front or second line follicular lymphoma in 5 years from now. So totally transformational.
I've got to ask you, although I'm kind of concerned you might go on for 20 minutes on this because it's so fascinating, but I'm just kind of curious. You were mentioning you've done some research on solid tumors. I'm just kind of curious, can you give us a little peek about whether you think that, you know, you were mentioning that DLL3 might be a better target than other solid tumors. Any sort of taste of what we might be looking at in terms of T-cell directed therapy in solid tumors?
So yeah, a solid tumor, just cell per cell, a little harder to kill than a lymphoma cell, myeloma cell, leukemia cell, but they are absolutely killable. And the proof of that we all know is we give anti-PD-1 every day, and that is a T cell killing a lung cancer cell, a melanoma cell, kidney cancer cell. I could do 20 minutes if you want, Neil. And yet people would say, where's the CAR T cells for the solid tumors? And the answer is, yeah, it's been tough. But it's not just that the cells are a little harder to kill, it's that the targets are harder to find. And DLL3, a pretty, not perfectly, but pretty clean target for small cell lung cancer. But even ovarian testicular cancer, we have some of these claudins, claudin 18.2 for some gastric cancers,
right,
claudin 6
right.
For ovarian. So the CAR Ts are coming, and the bispecifics probably are going to come even faster because they're so much easier to do the trials. And yeah, they're intended for the community centers, not for the academic centers. So they're coming more slowly, but yeah, they're coming.
So I've got to ask you about, here's some of the papers. You know, usually ASCO is not necessarily transformational in terms of heme. Sometimes it is. Certainly we saw the Hodgkin paper that was transformational. But Ticel, you know, I haven't seen much about mantle cell. I know we talked about it. It seemed like it made sense. Also, I was kind of hearing that maybe you see more tolerability issues with mantle cell. But can you kind of summarize what you presented here and what you think it means and kind of where what you see the algorithm? We have all these questions in the chat room about sequencing in mantle cell.
So I think the easy answer is it works. The harder one is obviously the administration of the medication is just a little bit harder than what we've seen in large cell lymphoma and follicular lymphoma, and I wholeheartedly just think it's just related to the disease. Mantle cell, unfortunately, circulates. It's in the bloodstream. It's probably in the bloodstream from almost all our patients who get diagnosed. We just don't look. And so, obviously, with any drug that you give, if your target is waiting for you when you open the door, that causes problems. That being said, I mean, obviously, the use of obinutuzumab as far as pretreatment in these patients helps quite a bit. Competitive binding, unfortunately, works in this situation. Or should I say fortunately for this point of matter, because it reduces some of the binding of glofitamab in the early phases, allows tolerance. And then the body, for some reason, in mantle cell lymphoma patients clears obinutuzumab quite quickly, so it doesn't interfere with the more effective doses as you get to 10 and 30. So the good things from that, as I said, it works. The patients who are in remission tended to stay in remission. The negatives, unfortunately, of the trial really are related to just the time frame that we conducted the study. I mean, it was during the heart of the pandemic, especially when Omicron came around, so we did have quite a few COVID events. And sadly, you know, of the 7 COVID deaths, 6 of those patients weren't in complete remission. So the curve that we presented obviously probably would have been a lot better if COVID-19 didn't exist, because these patients would probably still be in remission. So it does hint that this can likely provide some durable responses. And because in the post-BTK setting, it's very few options. I mean, you have Brexacil, which is a great drug and treatment, but the grade 3 to 4 ICANS even gives us pause, because it's something we can't predict in our patients. The Lysacel data, I will say, hopefully we'll get more clarification. It was a bit disappointing, I would say, as we were typically comparing these to be, you know, Honeycrisp to maybe a Fuji apple, and it may be apple to crab apple at this point. So it's something we need a little more clarification. So if glofitamab, it has breakthrough designation, if it moves forward, obviously, be honest, if I had to take a choice, if the duration of response and PFS curve remains how it is, then I think it's a suitable option for patients that you don't have to worry about the neurological toxicity, and you could potentially give that to patients even before the CAR T product. But we all know we can give bispecifics after CAR T, so, and I don't think, based on what we know, at least some data came from the Spanish group, I don't think bispecifics interfere with the effectiveness of the CAR T cells. So you can port these around as you see, but for community docs, obviously it's easier to give a bispecific than having to send a patient off to a CAR T center.
So, yeah, to be continued. This is going to be a topic of great discussion, I'm sure, for the next, the future. So we picked out, if you check out some of the papers we put in there that are being presented here at ASCO, but I just want to bring a couple others. And Ian, in terms of new approaches, particularly in follicular, you know, obviously the idea of maybe moving this up to untreated, there was a paper here by Laurie et al. And EBCO plus R-squared. But in general, any comment about what they presented, but also how you see new trials, so ongoing trials, even trials that oncologists could participate in, particularly in terms of the upfront treatment of FL?
Well, the study combining epcoritamab with R-squared was particularly attractive because of the very high overall and complete remission rate. So, you know, tremendous results there. And it's a, you know, quote-unquote chemo-free. Lenalidomide has its own issues, but I think a very attractive for patients, and the remission rates are really hard to argue with. So that was a really exciting results. We had seen some of that similar data in a relapse setting before as well, in combination with bispecifics. We've seen it in other settings, including aggressive lymphomas. So I think that's a combination that's here to stay. There is a trial with this, a large frontline study that's I don't know whether it's actually open yet, or but being planned in the frontline setting, I think that would be a great one for the community physicians. Hopefully, you know, using this new stepped up dosing, which is another slide that you have mentioned up there, that decreases the incidence of higher grade CRS, decreases the incidence of CRS overall, makes this an outpatient feasible antibody to give. I think this is another approach that the combination with R-squared is something that the community physicians could, you know, open a clinical trial at their center. So I think that's an exciting combination. And the data you have up there about the optimized dosing is another really important one. Even it's not a study. It was already done. It's not a new study. But I think this is, hopefully this will come out when we all anticipate this antibody to be approved in the near future for liquid lymphoma. Hopefully that allow these patients to be treated in the community and in the community physician's office and not have to go to the hospital.
So, Josh, any thoughts about that also in terms of the VOS presentation and what that meant?
Yeah, I'm actually still thinking about Tysel's apple, crab apple, Fuji apple, Honeycrisp apple metaphor. It was so nuanced and beautiful. And it was off the cuff because I know he didn't have that in his pocket from before. But I also have thoughts about, exactly as Ian said, this VOS abstract here, she presented it beautifully, and the result was that, the high-grade CRS was almost non-existent. The intention is for this to be an outpatient regimen, and the PDUFA date for EPCORE for follicular is at the end of this month. So we're going to have this pretty soon, and nice to see that this can mostly be all outpatient and done in the community, epcoritamab sub-Q.
So here are some other presentations, and one of the things that a lot of oncologists are asking about came up in the survey, Ian, and there's so many examples, and we've just in our 9 meetings are multiple examples where you have drugs within the same class and they're not compared directly. And, people have to do indirect comparisons. When you look at the available bispecifics, Ian, do you see fundamental differences, or is it really all about how the trials are done, how they develop the delivery system and schedule, what's more practical? Or do you think inherently they're different? We were talking about CDK inhibitors last night and breast cancer, and the feeling was they're more similar than different. Do you think that applies to bispecifics?
So personally, I think they're more similar than they are different. There are some very real differences in how they're given, how the schedules, the combinations that make, some easier. Maybe mosunetuzumab is a little bit inherently less CRS. That may be the way it was developed, though. If you look at the two from the same company, right, mosunetuzumab and glofitamab, to me, they do have a different profile there. Maybe mosunetuzumab is better suited to the follicular lymphoma where the indication is, probably because it has a little bit less, it has less CRS, but maybe a little bit less efficacy than glofitamab. But it's not worth, to me, it's not worth the adverse events associated with glofitamab in someone with follicular lymphoma, where it may be more useful in the more aggressive lymphomas. So trying to match the antibody to the disease, I think, is important. But I think if you look at the class, to me, they're more similar. I've been trying to use the different antibodies in trying to figure out which one I like better. And frankly, jury's still out.
So I want to move on and get to Tysel's talk here. I did want to point out, though, that there's, and we're going to talk later about some of the papers being presented at EHA, and in particular, the STARGLOW study. Glofitamab plus GemOx, interesting study. But we'll talk more about that when we get to diffuse large B-cell. But clearly, the STARGLOW study is something we need to discuss. So I'm just going to show you some of the cases and questions that we got from docs. Again, hundreds of them. After we go through the talk, I'm going to bring up a few of these. But Tysel, let's talk about bispecifics in relapse refractory diffuse large B-cell.
All right. So I will start off. apparently, I failed my homework assignment because there is a lot to get through in 8 minutes, but we will do our best. So just to start off, obviously, there are maybe two major bispecifics in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma based on approval. Epcoritamab is just the standard step-up dosing. For those who don't know, you started 0.16, 0.8, and then go to 48 milligrams. And as you can see, the dosing schedule weekly from cycles 1 through 3, every other week from 4 through 9, and then monthly there until treatment progression or unacceptable toxicity. And so at ASCO, we did update the PFS curve to give longer follow-up. So the important things about these bispecifics as we move forward is to try to see if there's some hint of stabilization with time. And as we can see, especially with patients who get a complete response, we are starting to see some stabilization of these curves long term, suggesting hopefully that we can get some of these patients to be cured. So of note, remember, epcoritamab is a treat to progression, so these patients are still on treatment. So that is another sort of concern we need to address, is if and when we can possibly stop epcoritamab in some of these patients. So CRS is a big concern, obviously, in our clinics and our offices and with our staff. So what they did look at is a way to improve sort of the tolerability of this. And so what they did was an optimization for patients with large cell lymphoma. And so what you see, they gave patients IV fluids. They used Decadron instead of prednisolone or prednisone. And they gave patients fluids the day of infusion, so the day before, the day of the infusion, and then some had them take fluid at home afterwards. And as what you can see in the colorful blue in boxes, as you can see, there's a reduction in CRS rates and incidence, and more importantly, no grade 3 events in these patients. So again, very comforting that we can possibly, again, port this completely to the outpatient with no severe grade 3 to 4 adverse events. And then combination trials are really the way to go. So Epcolin, this is in patients with large cell lymphoma. Early data, 32 patients, very high overall response rate, complete response rate. And again, as you can see very early on, there is some stabilization in the Kaplan-Meier plot. And if you look at the Swimmer's plot, you see some long-term responders. So again, very early hints of maybe some durable efficacy in these patients. Epcogemox, which was updated by Dr. Brody here, excellent presentation. Very high overall response rate. And in patients where this was given in the second line, very encouraging long-term duration of response. So again, calls into question whether these bispecifics can be upwardly mobile and start moving into earlier lines of therapy. And potentially maybe we get to a point where we start thinking about bispecifics in a second line and not CAR T in some of our patients. Epco-R-CHOP, fortunately and unfortunately, there are like 20 frontline trials ongoing. This is one of the many ones here. Again, very high overall response rate. So a little bit different in that, which we'll talk about, is the CRS with the EPCO-R-CHOP was a little bit different from what we saw with GLOFIT-R-CHOP, but that all really had to do was when the bispecific was sort of introduced into the patient. GLOFIT-R-CHOP, they did R-CHOP, then applied the GLOFIT, which allowed some cytotoxic treatment before you gave the bispecific, whereas in this one they were given simultaneously, so a little bit higher CRS. So odronextamab is the potential new kid to the block. As you can see from the dosing schedule, it is not as easy to give as the other two bispecifics. So you have split dosing from 1-2 of 8-9, 15-16, and then every other week you get a dose for cycles 3 through 4, and then once a month until treatment progression or intolerance. But the bigger issue is they made these changes because very early on there were higher rates of CRS. With the new split dosing, you see a marked reduction in the CRS events with the odronextamab, more in line with what we see with epcoritamab and glofitamab. Efficacy-wise, as we'll see in the next slide, it appears compare very favorably with the other two drugs as well.
So before you go on, we put in this slide just as a placeholder to see if people in the chat room have questions. There are a couple of really cool cases we'll get to later. But before you go on, incidentally, we stopped your timer, so you still have your 8 minutes. But I just wanted to pick up on something I think I heard you say when we were chatting and before we got started, which is I think you said people kind of think that the tolerability and side effect issues of bispecific is kind of similar or the same as CAR T, and I think you said it's not.
That is correct. I think they both cause CRS, but CRS with a CAR T product happens typically longer, lasts longer, and typically harder to resolve. With a bispecific antibody, you're not given a living treatment. This is an antibody. So sort of like any horror film, when you let the monster loose with CAR T, I mean, bad analogy, it's not really a monster, but you can't really control it once it goes into the patient. With a bispecific antibody, it has a certain half-life where you know it's going to be gone. So in most of these situations, we're dealing with events that will happen over the course of a few hours. They will resolve over the course of a few hours, maybe a day, and then you move on. So it's not necessarily as unpredictable or severe, and most of these events can be managed as an outpatient. Again, even some grade 2 CRS with bispecifics, you do not have to admit the patient. You can wholeheartedly manage this in your clinics.
So, Josh, you know, one of the things we've heard for a long time now, both with CAR T and bispecifics, that kind of hard to process into practical recommendations. CRS is one thing, but risk of infection to me is complicated in terms of prevention, treatment, management, diagnosis. I mean, there's a lot to say about that. Maybe you can just start the discussion in terms of, you know, how, what you would recommend to a doc who's following a patient on bispecifics in terms of prevention and detection of infection.
Yeah, overall, even though these medicines are generally safer than many other, you know, chemotherapies we're using every day in our clinic, they do have these kind of particular risks. And the infection risks are some of them related to hypogammaglobulinemia. We're giving B-cell depletion in some cases for 9 months, some cases for 2 years. So, yeah, we, Tysel was mentioning he monitors IgG on his patients very frequently. We're, I think, pretty similar. And patients that are getting hypogammaglobulinemic, we've got a very low threshold to start them on monthly IVIG, probably, I don't know, 20% of our patients getting these end up on IVIG eventually. It's not a lot, but it's something. More importantly, and acutely, the first cycle of these therapies, there's a lot of steroids, as Tysel was hinting, dexamethasone and prednisone for some of them. And with all those steroids, yeah, there is a risk, a small but real risk of PJP, of shingles, of varicella. So we are prophylaxing in the early time points, certainly with Bactrim 3 times a week and with valacyclovir or acyclovir to prevent those, you know, almost no febrile neutropenias with any of these, but those simpler viral and PJP infections, yeah, worth prophylaxing against.
Ian, what about COVID? Is that still an important issue with these patients?
I mean, it's not the issue that it was, but it's still an important issue. And I think educating your patients about the risk of viral infections, because I think there's a sort of feeling that there's no problem anymore. But I do think even the other common viruses, adenovirus, other things that are circulating, flu that are circulating in the community at various times, I think are important for our patients to understand that they have to take a little bit extra step of caution there.
All right. Let's go back to Tysel and glofitamab.
All right, so just to get restarted. So glofitamab is the last bispecific we'll talk about. The schedule, as you can see, is a little bit different from what we saw with epcoritamab and odronextamab. So this one gives you obinutuzumab pretreatment for some competitive binding with glofitamab. The antibodies are generally built off of each other. And so after the obinutuzumab, the next week you get glofitamab 2.5, the following week 10 milligrams, then the following week 30 milligrams, and then every 3 weeks thereafter. So Martin Hutchinson presented this at our most recent ASH meeting. As you can see, these patient population, the more important thing is the curve to the right. Again, you do see at 24 months that a little over half of these patients are still in remission. Again, this is a finite treatment, so patients are getting treatment for 8.3 months. So anything after 9 months, these patients are not on therapy. So hinting at possibly some durable remissions and possible cure, which we'll hopefully see with more mature data. Again, adverse events. So the key takeaway from this, the more bulky the disease in this situation, or higher tumor metabolic tumor volume, what we see in these situations is higher incidence of CRS in these patients, possibly giving us a predictive sort of potential to identify which patients may need hospitalized and which ones will not. So hopefully with further follow-up, we'll get more clarification on that curve to the right about which patients have higher incidence of cytokine release syndrome with total metabolic tumor volume as a predictive marker. So here's just a summary of how we can look at all these bispecifics. Overall response rate, complete response rate, what we've reported out for PFS, duration of response, whether we have an approval, and also some of the issues in the post-CAR-T patients, because as of right now, these are positioned post-CAR-T. So a few combinations with this. As I mentioned before, this one's a little bit different than what we saw with epcoritamab. As you see, the R-CHOP or polar R-CHIP is first, then glofitamab is given in the second week. So as you can see, very high in typical patient characteristics. The more important thing to take away from this, very high complete response rate, but we see that a lot in these early phase studies. But if you look at the CRS, which is in the box to the right, as you can see, there were no grade 3 CRS events, and actually CRS was very low in this situation, actually in the GoFit Polar R-CHIP, single digits, even with a percentage. So again, very possible we can give these in frontline therapy, and also without the need to give any sort of hospitalization with the very low rates of CRS and no high-grade CRS. So GloFit Pola, obviously, mechanistically, they own the drugs. This is why they're doing it. So giving them together, polatuzumab is given for 6 cycles. Again, you see about a little less than a third of these patients had prior CAR-T, so not necessarily an apples-to-apples comparison with what we saw with the original polatuzumab trial, where about a third of those patients had CAR-T. So high overall response rate, Very early, but again, the duration of complete response, progression-free survival, hinting potentially of maybe some synergistic activity. I do not think we get as much benefit from polatuzumab or glofitamab as we do with mosunetuzumab, but glofitamab seems to be a more effective bispecific compared to mosunetuzumab, especially in large cell lymphoma. Safety-wise, again, Pola did its job. It reduced the CRS events. Again, very few grade 3-4 CRS at all in this patient population, mostly grade 1 to 2. Again, mostly with the first dose of glofitamab, the 2.5 milligram dose. I cannot pronounce this drug, so we will call it the glofitamab 4-1BB. Again, this is a co-stim to help induce more T-cell activity, very similar with the co-stim that we see with the CAR-T products. So these drugs were given together from cycle 2 to 8 onward and then every 3 weeks. So no increased risk of adverse events. So CRS appears to be the same as glofitamab, higher incidence of COVID-19, but that's obviously when we conducted these trials. Efficacy-wise, there would seem to be more benefit, at least early on, in the indolent non-Hodgkin's lymphoma subsets, but I believe there will be an update of this presentation at EHA. And then lastly, we'll talk about STARGLO. We'll really have to see how this presents out, but it is an overall survival benefit of this over GemOx, and obviously could be something that can be integrated in the community, especially where there's quite a familiarity with GemOx in this patient population. And a few seconds over, but that's just a summary of how we got the bispecifics in large cell lymphoma.
So, so much there to talk about. One thing I'm just kind of curious about, I'll ask Josh, any correlation between CRS or any other toxicity issues in treatment benefit? And we have this discussion about IOs, but what about with bispecifics, even CAR-T?
Yeah, you have a lot of those correlations in checkpoint blockade. Getting the rash means you're going to get the response. But it's here, the correlate of getting CRS are just these known things, higher tumor bulk. And as Tysel was hitting with mantle cell, you know, tumor bulk doesn't just have to be a lump or a grapefruit or a Fuji apple or something. It can be leukemic phase disease. Having a little cancer in the blood adds up to a lot of cancer. So that's the best predictor of CRS, the best clinical one and probably the most robust. And yeah, that almost anti-correlates with response. So no, getting these, and actually we kind of like to make this point. We've had patients say, I didn't get the fever, so is the medicine working? No, the medicine is working, and you see the CR rates and the response rates are awesome, and it's irrespective of CRS. So no tight correlation, maybe even a slight anti-correlation.
Ian, I'm really fascinated by the idea of combining a bispecific with a Pola-R chip. There's so much debate about that, also in terms of the impact based on subset, diffuse B-cell in terms of that. Any thoughts about, any predictions, any thoughts about how these agents are going to work in terms of being combined with, first-line therapy at this point?
I mean, I think mechanistically it's sort of interesting by combining the bispecific with the antibody-drug conjugate on the backbone of R-CHOP. It is a really high standard to get over, right? I mean, you think about where it's taken, a couple decades before we even got a regimen that was better than R-CHOP. It's not universally adopted so far, but I think in many patients it is an advancement. I think it's a great trial. It's a great thought. It's a great approach. But whether it ultimately ends up winning or not, I don't know.
So, Tysel, I'm curious. I think you kind of alluded to the possibility that maybe chemo would reduce CRS.
Yeah, I think we've seen with all of these combination regimens, whether it's chemo or even ADCs, that the cytotoxic components of these drugs has reduced the incidence of CRS, especially if you time it appropriately. So as you compare the two trials, only because of the CRS events, when EPCO gave R-CHOP, they gave it at the same time. You saw more CRS than when you saw with glofit R-CHOP. But again, in that trial, R-CHOP went first, and then the next week they gave the glofit. So you had that cytotoxic drug there, reducing some of the disease burden and even some of the immune cells that react to the bispecific. So it seems to be a strategy moving forward as a way to reduce some of these adverse events.
Again, I'm curious, Josh, your thoughts, at least theoretically, based on what we know about this, particularly from a translational point of view, whether you think, there's a debate about does a Pola-R chip work differently based on a subset, whether it's germinal or non-germinal. Do you see bispecifics in any way kind of complementing it?
Yeah, this Pola-R chip, the Polaric study, it wasn't the primary intended outcome, but the subset analysis of non-GC was so much more benefit than the GC subgroup that we're a little shy to, you know, make clinical decisions based on post-hoc subset analysis. But the truth is we do, or I'll speak for our institution, you know, non-GC patient much more likely to get Pollard shipped than a GC patient. So, yeah, maybe in the future, you know, Tysel describing these frontline trials, Epcor R-CHOP, GLOFIT Pollard chip, I could conceive of the possibility that we could be given GLOFIT Pollard chip for the non-GCs and maybe Epcor R-CHOP. This is, a, you know, depending on how the data shakes out. But, yeah, the subset analysis was a real thing for Polarix trial and seems to work better. And it's not that surprising because we do see that Pol actually itself, monotherapy, has a little more benefit in the non-GC patients.
I just kind of wonder what kind of assays are getting done in the community and whether you can actually depend upon that. But that's sort of another discussion that we've had quite a few times. So how about a little palate cleanser with a case from the chat room? Ian, you want to take a shot at this one?
Sure.
This is a rapid fire here. This is from Priya Rudolph. She was actually in our meeting last night. We got through 10 o'clock last night, and as she participated, now she's back here this morning. You ready? Here we go. 60-year-old, double hit, diffuse large B-cell, stage 4, liver, spleen, bone marrow, has near CR to dose-adjusted EPOC, only site of PET activity was right cervical lymph node biopsy with persistent disease. Per transplant doc, he got local RT to the lymph node, followed by CAR-T with axi-cel, February 2024. Repeat PET scan shows new activity in the same cervical biopsy, proven relapse, no other sites. Ian, what's the next best treatment to provide potentially curative approach? I'm just reading what she says for a young, otherwise healthy patient.
I'm glad I got the easy one up front. I am concerned that we can promise a, or we can lead a patient like this to the notion of cure necessarily. I don't think there is a standard therapy there that will be curative for the vast majority of patients. Maybe one of the accommodations that we saw earlier, maybe, you know, combining a chemotherapy with a bispecific might be helpful. I'm concerned, you know, the obvious thing is say, well, let's go with a bispecific right now. I mean, we've seen data from a variety of different settings where you use bispecifics in patients that relapse with large cell lymphoma after CAR T cells. And there is a little bit of a difference in the setting that it sounded to me like this was a rapid relapse. It happened almost immediately after the CAR T cells.
Right.
And that patient population that relapsed within, you know, a few months, 30 days, 90 days, I think that the outcomes are really, really, really challenging with almost anything, and that includes a bispecific. The other issue, I think, is in this patient, whether really their ability to tolerate, after a CAR T cell, to tolerate standard cytotoxic chemotherapy with a bispecific might be hard as well. So, you know, I don't have a ready answer here. I think we in desperate times, you do desperate things, and maybe trying, depending on their counts, you might want to try one of these combinations.
So, actually, one of the most common reactions we get from docs from our stuff is when you don't know what to do and they feel better that they're not by themselves and you don't have the magic answer. But 95% of the time, you know, it's the same scenario. One final thought, just in anticipation of EHA, Josh, curious how you're kind of going to take, we don't know the data at this point from STARGLOW, but GEMOX, interesting choice there. How do you think people are going to look at the data? I'm sure it's going to depend on what the data look like, but any thoughts about what you're going to look for?
Yeah, I mean, it's even relevant for that case that just came up, and as Ian said,
right.
It's a tough case, and hard to promise things there, and no matter what we give, we're not going to feel super confident about it, but GEMOX plus both bispecifics has got a lot of, you know, already phase 1-2 data. So the STARGLOW is going to be the first phase 3 data of that. And they told us about an overall survival delta. So, you know, hopefully that will go along with the pretty high remission and CR rates we've seen in the phase 2 data. So phase 2, you know, we've seen CR rates above 60% in this third line setting. A lot of those patients post-CAR T, maybe not all double hits like that case we just heard about, but still, you know, pretty bad patient cohorts. I mean, honestly, overall survival delta, what I think is going to be a comparably well-tolerated regimen, GEMOX versus GLOFIT GEMOX, I think that should make, if you're considering GEMOX, should make GLOFIT GEMOX the standard of care. Overall survival delta, I mean, that's the gold standard of why we do these trials.
So, Tysel, a little more information from the chat room from Priya. Actually, the patient now is on Tafa-Len, and she's saying the bone marrow folks want to do another CAR-T.
That's interesting. Very difficult case. So what we do know is from at least some early data that came out of the Spanish group is that patients who relapse very early to CAR-T tend not to necessarily have great responses to bispecific, as Ian was mentioning. Lintaf in this situation obviously was never really designed to be treated in a primary refractory patient, so there's very little data about Lintaf's efficacy in a patient like this. And if we extrapolate the very small data from that Spanish study, it appears like treatments like Pola-BR are actually probably a bit more effective in this early phase, cytotoxic drugs after CAR-T if the patient could tolerate it in this situation. Now, in regards to another CAR-T product, obviously it would be hoped that they're targeting something other than CD19. We did see a study from UPenn with an armored CAR-T after CD19, but most of those patients had relapsed, meaning they were actually given that treatment quite a bit of time after the original CAR-T product. So if it is another CD19 CAR-T, I think most of us would not necessarily think that's a good idea. There are other CAR-T products like the CD22 CAR-T product from Cargo that appears very promising in patients post CD19 CAR-T. I know there are other CAR-T targeted other receptors, which would be my recommendation if you're going to use another CAR-T product. If not, I think we need to look for other combinations or other treatments for this patient other than just sort of repeating the same thing with a 4-1BB CAR-T, which obviously I don't think would make much of a difference in this patient.
Yeah, so actually she says, thank you very much, very helpful. CAR-T with CD22 on your trial, I guess that's what,
yeah.
So just what you're saying. All right, let's get back to the data. Now we're going to talk about follicular lymphoma and bispecifics. We've been getting so many clinical questions. I think we're just going to go right to the data. Ian, let's talk about it.
Sure. So I'm going to talk a little bit about follicular lymphoma and bispecifics. And you know, mosunetuzumab was the first to date only bispecific approved for follicular lymphoma. We hope that another one will be shortly coming. But this is an update from that original pivotal trial. Here's some of the baseline demographics just to refresh people's memory. These were pretty heavily pretreated patients. More than half of these had POD24. So it was a difficult to treat patient population. And these are the most updated progression, sees the duration of response curves. In a second, I'll show the progression-free survival curves. Overall response rate, 80%, CR rate, 60%. You think about it, where we've come in the field, 60% CR rate and third line plus seems like a real achievement in follicular lymphoma. And these remissions are durable. Of course, if you're seeing these slides, the patients who got a complete remission really benefited from the bispecifics. Those patients who were only a PR didn't do nearly as well. But thankfully, it was more than half these patients who achieved a complete remission. These are progression-free survival curves. And again, you're seeing median PFSs of 2 years. And so I think that's a major difference, a major movement forward. And some of these patients were more than half were POD24, if you think about it. So getting even better responses here, more durable remissions. CRS, we've been talking about CRS a lot today. And this is an important consideration when using any bispecifics. But as you can see from this slide, that the vast majority, if not all, the significant CRS occurs during the first cycle. It's generally grade 1 or grade 2, very rare event to have anything more than that. And again, it happens at the maximum dose. So each bispecific, where the patient gets the peak incidence of CRS tends to differ based on that antibody and the schedule. With mosunetuzumab, it tends to be on the third dose. And as you see here, after you get past that, really not a big issue. So we've also talked about, briefly about using antibodies in follicular lymphoma in the front line. There's been a couple studies that have looked at mosunetuzumab as a single agent, and there's also data in combination. But as a single agent, mosunetuzumab, this publication, overall response rate of 96%, complete remission rate of 76%. So really, amazingly fantastic data. The results really were pretty good across the different subgroups. Maybe there was a little bit higher a response rate in those patients who didn't have really high SUVs. When you have high SUVs, it always brings up the question of whether there's some undetected transformation to a more aggressive lymphoma. But it stood up pretty well even in those patients with high SUVs, but did fantastic in those patients with SUVs of less than 13. I mentioned earlier that glofitamab, Tysel took us through the data in large cell lymphoma. And it's also been investigated in follicular lymphoma. In general, it's being reserved for aggressive lymphomas, but as you can see here, a variety of different doses and schedules that have been tested in a larger study. The one that was settled on was with more stepped up dosing with obinutuzumab pre-treatment. On the right, you see that cohort of patients with follicular lymphoma, 100% overall response rate, 74% complete remission rate, and the rest had partial remissions. You can break that down, those different schedules, by the different types of lymphoma double refractory, POD24s. And again, the really high overall response rate in that dose schema that was finally settled upon, as you see here, and many of those patients getting a complete remission in this patients with a number of prior therapies. You know, the trade-off, as I mentioned earlier, the trade-off really is that there's a higher incidence of CRS with glofitamab in follicular lymphoma as it is in other diseases. And so, as you can see here, and some of it's a little bit, while it's predominantly grade 2 or 1 or 2 in that optimized schedule, it's still 70, nearly 79, nearly 80% of patients are getting CRS. And so I think that's really why the manufacturers have targeted mosunetuzumab for follicular lymphoma and glofitamab for aggressive lymphomas.
I think maybe we just keep going.
So next is odronextamab. Tysel gave us a little background about that earlier. It's also been investigated in follicular lymphoma, and here this is the demographics of the patients that were treated on this study. Slightly less than half were POD24. Many were refractory to their last therapy. Many had a stem cell transplant. Overall response rate in this population was 80% with a CR rate of 72%. So really, most of the people that responded got complete remissions on this. The PFS of this was a little bit less than we saw previously, 20.7, but I think given the differences in patient populations, it's really hard to compare across the different studies. 3 overall survival, 63%. So, again, the cytokine release syndrome is an issue to be considered, to dealt with. Again, there's different dosing regimens. On the more three-step dosing regimen with odronextamab, you get a diminishing of the grade 2 CRS, and most of it now becomes grade 1, so a much more benign profile in that. So about half of the patients are getting CRS, but very few people are getting high-grade CRS. And finally, epcoritamab is also being investigated in follicular lymphoma. There was a large trial that was conducted, and there was a follicular lymphoma cohort within that patient population. These patients had a median of 3 lines prior therapy. 42% were POD24 patients. This is the waterfall plot, which you can see the overall response rate was 82%, CR rate of 63% in this patient population, and then also looking at CRS as well. So any grade was 66%, 40% grade 1, 25% grade 2. And I think we talked about earlier about the notion that you can optimize the dosing and decrease the incidence of higher grade CRS in with epcoritamab, making it possibly an outpatient regimen in the near future. So what combination, we talked a little bit about combining bispecifics with R-squared. There was a publication that was updated this year, and then we mentioned earlier that in with epcoritamab and R-squared. So an overall response rate of 95%, CR rate of 85% in frontline follicular lymphoma. So, that's really almost, there's not a lot of room to go better than that, right? I mean, that is just awesome results. We'll need to see further follow-up in terms of the durability, but you have to, the first look looks pretty good that many of these responses are quite durable. And then just to mention, mosunetuzumab has also been combined with lenalidomide, not R-squared, but just lenalidomide in relapsed and refractory follicular lymphoma. Here also a very high overall response rate of nearly 90%, two-thirds of these patients achieving a complete remission. And it was successful across the different subtypes, the different prognostic groups within follicular lymphoma, POD24, CD20 refractory, double refractory. It looked like it worked really pretty well across these different subgroups. And so then just to mention a trial that the Celestimo study that is combining this regimen, so mosun plus lenalidomide versus R-squared in patients with relapsed and refractory follicular lymphoma. Here, the therapy is really just about a year long, not 2 years as we see in some different studies. And hopefully, this will really clearly demonstrate the efficacy of combining a bispecific with lenalidomide in the relapse setting in follicular lymphoma.
So we're going to move on a second and have Josh talk about tolerability issues. Really cool question in the chat room, though, Tysel, from Yasna. For a patient right now presenting, progressing on R-squared, mm-hmm. zanubrutinib with abin versus abin with mosin.
So in this situation, my initial response would be mosunetuzumab. It's a finite treatment. Efficacy between the two drugs are very similar. We probably have more mature data with the duration of response with mosunetuzumab. And obviously, I know the BTK inhibitors have been something we've tried to move into follicular lymphoma for quite a bit of time. But again, it is still a treat to progression, which obviously necessitates more long-term maintenance and follow-up. So in this situation, it would be mosunetuzumab would be my choice.
All right, let's go on and let Josh talk about his thoughts in terms of tolerability with bispecifics.
Neil, thank you. We're just trying to convey here that these therapies are really overall quite accessible to community docs, and although their history has been in academia, their future is in the community. Luckily, Ian and Tysel did all the work for me, and I don't got to restate everything here. We have these first three approved respectively in follicular, then in DLBCL, DLBCL, and odronextamab, still waiting for its approval, and I won't go into details of how these molecules look, mostly more similar than different with some important differences. And we sometimes just feel like the community docs think, oh, T-cell therapy, that sounds like CAR T-cell, that sounds like it could be toxic. Some similarity in mechanism, but overall a lot of big logistical differences and, most importantly, safety differences. So most importantly, accessibility. The difficulties of CAR T-cell is not what we sometimes talk about, the vein-to-vein time when you ferrete them to when you give it, but we say that, I think this Matt Lunning's word, brain-to-vein time, I attribute Matt to this one. When you think of the idea versus when you actually get it into the vein of your patients, and there's a lot of obstacles, referring to the CAR T center, the fax machine was broken, there's a lot of things that delay the brain-to-vein time relative to the vein-to-vein time. AxiCell, 12 to 15 days vein-to-vein time, but yeah, can still be many weeks between when the patient needs the therapy and when they actually get it. So that's the first obvious thing, off-the-shelf bispecific antibody therapy. They can. Yesterday, Gilles told about a patient who was inpatient last week who they decided to do it, and then within 90 minutes, patient got the therapy. So we haven't got 90 minutes yet. I think we had maybe a 120 at our best. But yeah, you can quickly get the medicine for the patients, and that some of them require today some inpatient stay, but as was alluded to, we're working these towards being primarily outpatient therapies, especially for follicular and low-grade lymphomas. So most importantly, maintaining the relationship with the community doc and not necessarily having to send this patient in to the academic center. Increasing access to care is the big deal. I won't belabor these points for the sake of time. The a priori, getting the patient set for therapy also a bit easier. In standard, no fancy labs required. There are some fancy labs we do, in the research context, measuring these inflammatory markers, CRP, ferritin, and so forth, but none of them necessary for regular management. And also just other testing. We do not routinely do MUG or TTEs, echoes on most of our patients. If we have an 85-year-old who doesn't walk upstairs and doesn't walk, we want to know what his EF is. But for the vast majority of his patients, as opposed to CAR T-cell therapy, no a priori cardiac or pulmonary testing, so another big difference from CAR T-cell or, of course, transplant therapy. And the other most important pre-treatment preparation thing is, I think we mentioned it a few times, although steroids are used, nowadays we realize dexamethasone is the preferred steroid in terms of keeping CRS rates low. So, yeah, just prepping patients for what steroids feel like. If they haven't, already had R-CHOP or some other exposure to prednisone, this is going to make your husband crazy for a couple days, but, maybe he was crazy already. So the steroids are something that we are used to at least preparing patients to take. So these are the, fairly straightforward prep things to get patients ready. I'm sorry, I should have mentioned one other thing, that even though high-grade CRS rates are quite low, we have to acknowledge the possibility and that our hospital nearby should have tocilizumab in stock in case the patient needs it, although it's quite rare and rarely used in most of these trials. And, yeah, we have to clarify just the logistics of this. you know, on the 3% chance that you're going to get a higher grade CRS, you need to be within this many minutes to of the nearby hospital. And most importantly, as Ian was saying, educating the patients of this is not a big deal, but this is the red flag that you have to bring the patient in for. Even though they're rare, a lot of education required. Again, we have these three approved so far, just reemphasizing that Mosun and Glofit on the ends there are intravenous so far. They may become sub-Q therapies in the future, and epcoritamab sub-Q therapy. And not a big deal for us, but a big deal for some of our patients. We have third-line, fourth-line patients who have lost their veins. Their port had a clot, and we say, well, you have a choice here. You know, Epcor, Glofit, both pretty effective for DLBCL. And for some patients, the sub-Q route of administration is a big deal. And I won't go into more details there. Into the timing of the step-up dosing. But you see the recurring theme they all have so far, these kind of triple step-ups. And as Ian was mentioning, we're working on a quadruple step-up for epcoritamab for low-grade lymphoma especially. And right now, today, mosunetuzumab, follicular lymphoma, third-line approval, no inpatient monitoring required at all. And the FDA label for Epcor and Glofit for DLBCL, the label says, should monitor for one day after the critical dose, and the critical dose is the third dose for Epcor and the first Glofit dose for Glofit. And when a label says should, people ask me, does that mean I need to? Yeah, should unfortunately means mandatory. That's a little confusing that they nuanced that. Should means, yeah, you gotta. So this might change. Epcoritamab has got a follicular lymphoma upcoming approval, and I can't tell you what that label looks like. I don't work for the FDA, but you should look at that label because it might look a little different than this for the follicular lymphomas. But for the DLBCLs right now today, one-day hospitalization, and that's been a big deal for our community oncology buddies because not simple to do, but we're going to work on that more as we go, and I want to comment more on the future of it. I just want to remind people that I'm from New York. I talk real fast. People don't hear, but I say, but the internet here has all of it. And these are some very good references. And if you snapshot this slide, you have all of these, especially this great paper by Dr. Crombie and team describing overall recommendations for preventing and managing toxicities from bispecifics, especially CRS. And these very rare icons, neurotoxicity, side effects. So good online references that are pretty accessible. And CRS, again, is, of course, the main thing we talk about. I won't do too much on pathophysiology, but it's kind of what it sounds like. Both the T cells that are mobilized and redirected by the bispecifics and some of the other cells in the tumor microenvironment in the endothelia spit out some cytokines, and interferon gamma TNF are part of it. But certainly the famous and actionable one is they spit out interleukin-6, and it's actionable because we have an anti-interleukin-6 receptor antibody, tocilizumab. I think people all know that IL-6 causes fevers, and tocilizumab, quite awesome at blocking those fevers when they persist. So some of it conceptual, but some of it very actionable in terms of how we manage the patients. Fever is the main symptom of CRS and really the sine qua non of this is or isn't CRS. And again, the onsets are a bit variable between the agents, between the sub-Qs and IVs. But generally, they're starting within the first 1 to at most 3 days, mostly for most patients, and mostly occurring at this critical jump up during the up titration. And CRS after the first cycle, certainly after the second cycle, extraordinarily rare. If someone has a fever after the first or second cycle, more likely it's something else other than CRS. It's a routine flu or some other infection. First cycle, CRS, fever is the main symptom, but all of these other organ systems can be affected, and certainly higher grade CRS, and I have a little bit about the grading here, but as you can see, not that you have to memorize all the columns. Grade 1 is fever, and grade 2 is when you start to get low blood pressure, and it is low blood pressure that doesn't really require medical management. It requires either PO hydration or IV hydration. And then grade 3 and above, that's when these patients need to be hospitalized for medical management of primarily of low blood pressure. I won't go into more details how we manage it, but it's mostly about steroids and tocilizumab. And there are very rare refractory patients, not so much with the bispecifics. Again, the bispecifics have low rates of high grade. You see in that second column there, high-grade CRS, you know, low single digits for most of these, and some of them in the combination regimens as low as 0% for the more recent studies. And we can pause there.
Keep going.
Good. Good. Only a couple left to go. Neurotoxicity ICONs, extraordinarily rare, low single digits. And the truth is ICONs can be any kind of neurotoxic syndrome, but of course it is, again, within a certain few days of getting these higher doses during the step-up. And I won't go into the grading, but if people can still speak to you, they have low grade, and high grade is they can't speak to you. And we don't really have the optimal management, but it's mostly about steroids because tocilizumab not as effective for treating ICONs. And I just wanted to have this one real last slide, skip the rest of it, to point out that myeloma bispecifics, great medicines, but have a little bit given a bad rap because of some of the complexities and especially the infection rates here. You see top few columns there, the grade 3 and above infections, quite common, more than a third of patients, as opposed to the lymphoma bispecifics, 1 out of 7 patients getting high-grade infections.
So, you know, we spent 2 hours on this in some CME programs, and we can't cover it in 2 hours. We can't cover it in 1 hour, no matter how fast we talk. This is just a huge and really fascinating topic. Faculty, thank you so much. Tysel and Ian, we worked with you before. And Josh, audience, a star is born, an RTP star is born, I think, here. We got to get you back here and give you a little more time.
I'm but the Lady anyhow, Gaga.
Be safe. Stay well. Thanks so much, faculty. And thank you for listening and attending here today, audience. Have a great day. Thanks a lot. Thank you so much.